Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Joe Selby, executive director of PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at research into ways that online interactions can influence offline behavior. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
Low literacy rates have been linked to poorer health outcomes around the globe, so Nicholas Negroponte decided he should do something about that. The chairman emeritus of the MIT Media Lab has been on a mission since 2005, the year he launched One Laptop Per Child, whose mission is exactly that. Negroponte figured his organization could meaningfully change the lives of about 100 million children living in the world without access to education. He felt that such a sturdy, child-friendly laptop relying on solar power could change that statistic. What they found in this stage of the project was pretty astounding. Not only were children learning to read and acquiring knowledge, but they were also teaching their illiterate parents how to read.
What if we go to these parts of the world where there are no schools? There aren't any. There are no literate adults. And, of course, the children are illiterate. 100 million. What can we learn from the kids teaching their parents is that we can try an experiment where the kids teach themselves. And that's the new story.
Negroponte was so inspired by the children teaching the adults that he tried an experiment in an Ethiopian village that had no teachers, no schools, no literacy. That brought boxes of computers to the village, left them there with no one to instruct the children in any way.
Within 5 days, they were using 47 apps per child per day. Within 2 weeks, they were singing ABC songs in the village. And within 5 months, they had hacked Android.
Negroponte, speaking at a recent M-Tech conference at MIT, says this could enable a whole new way of teaching around the globe that effectively has the power to eliminate illiteracy. And one hopes improve the economic and health figures of these children as well. The One Laptop Per Child organization now has deployed 3 million computers in 40 countries and 25 languages, distributing a simple, durable laptop into the lives of children who would have otherwise been left illiterate, changing their world for the better and offering a promise of a brighter future. Now that's a bright idea. We're speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, Executive Director of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, known as PCORI, an independent nonprofit health research organization authorized by the Affordable Care Act. PCORI was created to provide patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. Dr. Selby is a family physician, a clinical epidemiologist, and recently served as the director of the Division of Research at Kaiser Permanente, where he oversaw 500 research clinicians and 250 ongoing studies. Dr. Selby is an author of more than 200 peer-reviewed articles and continues to focus his study efforts on diabetes and quality improvement. Dr. Selby, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you very much, Mark and Margaret. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, we saw that President Obama was reelected, which really bodes well for the continued advancement laid out in the Affordable Care Act, which established PCORI to shift the focus of healthcare research to really take into account the patient-centered experience and to evaluate patient outcomes so that improved quality and patient outcomes govern health policy and practices. So, could you tell our listeners a little more about PCORI and what's new and innovative about your approach and what kind of impact you expect to have on patient outcomes in healthcare?
Yes, PCORI is brand new, and I want to emphasize that PCORI is a research funding organization. So we will be providing funding to researchers, to clinicians, to patients, particularly when they join together to apply for funding. And we are interested in research questions that provide useful information to patients and their caregivers and their clinicians as they face critical healthcare decisions. It's the existence of PCORI and its placement in the Affordable Care Act. Recognize that despite the fact that we actually spend $150 or $60 billion a year on clinical research, in this country alone, it's still the case that patients and their clinicians often get to a decision point and don't have practical information that really compares two or more options that form a decision that patients have to make. So we focus on trying to fill that void, provide that clinical information, and we pay particular attention to what works for whom. So we recognize that the same treatment doesn't work exactly as well for every patient, and sometimes one has to tailor these treatments to who the patient is.
So, Dr. Selby, the PCORI model set out to establish a format, kind of a new format, for researching outcomes to involve patients and their providers, and to do it using comparative clinical analysis. And in an article in Health Affairs, you outlined two very different research approaches: investigator-generated research, such as clinical drug trials by pharmaceutical companies or testing of surgical devices, but also a patient stakeholder-led approach. Tell us about the difference between these two research protocols, and how does that play out in a research protocol? What does it mean to have a patient stakeholder approach?
Well, we're trying to get the patient's voice and the clinician's voice into the research process. And we think that if we do that, it's more likely that when the research is done, it'll answer the right questions. Oftentimes, the research is done, it's very elegant research, it just doesn't quite answer the question that clinicians were asking or patients were asking. So it sits on the shelf. And one of the reasons is it's tough to change practice, but we really think a second reason is the question wasn't quite asked right. So we have two approaches to getting those right questions. They can both be, really, frankly, just about any kind of clinical question. So it's not a distinction between, on the one hand, what a pharmaceutical company might want to study, and on the other hand, what a patient might want to study. It's a distinction between how we find out what's of interest to patients. And we really think both pathways are important, and we'll use both pathways extensively. In the first one, which you've called the investigator-generated research, we send out broad announcements explaining the kinds of research comparisons that we're interested in. We don't say we're interested in studying diabetes, for example, or depression. We say send us the most compelling questions. And when you do, join with patients, join with the relevant clinicians, and tell us why this question is important to patients. So we're very open and interested in what researchers and patients and other stakeholders come up with on their own and submit to us. So that's pathway number one. But pathway number two is sometimes patients and clinicians and others aren't really prepared to just sit down and write a research proposal. Sometimes they need to talk directly with us. And so we engage patients and their patient organizations, clinicians and their organizations in a kind of ongoing brainstorming session that looks for the right questions. And then we invite them to join us in prioritizing them and helping us decide which questions, if answered, would be the most likely to provide information that's lacking now, the most likely to change practice, the most likely to improve outcomes. And then we solicit research for those very specific ideas.
Dr. Selby, you bring a nice combination of qualities to your position. You're a brilliant research leader and you're a tireless patient advocate. You've identified five key target areas in particular. Can you tell us a little more about what they are and how will they govern where PCORI grants go in the future?
The statute itself told us that before we could start funding research, we had to get together with the stakeholder community and identify the priorities that would guide our research. Now, they could have been very narrow priorities. We could have focused in just on five diseases if you wish. We didn't. We named five broad priority areas, and I'll tell them to you in just a minute, but I'll just say that we think they fit together nicely. They're all essential, and if you don't do research and improve our knowledge and practice in each of these areas, probably the gains you make in the other areas aren't going to be very effective. Mm-hmm. So here's the first one. It's called assessment of options for prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. That really gets at questions at the patient level about which treatment or which preventive measure works best for me. that's kind of the classic comparative effectiveness research paradigm. And that's only one of our five priorities. The second one is called improving healthcare systems. And so that just recognizes what I know you two know, that the system where patients get their care has a lot to do with whether they hear the options, whether they get the options, whether they get follow-up, whether their care is coordinated. And this country has a long ways to go in understanding what kind of systems work best for whom. So improving healthcare systems is the second. The third is called communication and dissemination research. And that just recognizes the fact that once you get the evidence collected and established, you've got to find ways to get it out to the offices and into the homes and the schools so that people are aware of the evidence. We all have to work on improving the way that patients and their clinicians and their caregivers communicate with each other. The fourth is addressing disparities, and that just is based on the widely recognized fact now that treatments don't work the same for everybody. And if we apply a one-size-fits-all approach, we're going to leave large numbers of our folks in this country without good outcomes. So we start from the fact that there are disparities, and we say we will fund research that addresses ways, comparative studies of ways to eliminate those disparities. And the fifth is a priority about building the infrastructure to do more of this research. We really think we need to change the culture in this country so that out in the clinics, out in the hospitals, out in the healthcare systems, we are asking and answering these questions all the time, that patients and their clinicians come to recognize that when you don't know the answer, when you're making decisions and advising patients on what to do and you realize you don't really know the answer, the best thing to do is ask the question and get the answer. And for that, you need an infrastructure. You need to put clinical data together into large databases. You need to find ways to analyze those data more effectively, so you need better methods. And we need to train both researchers and clinicians and patients to participate in this research. So that's the fifth one, our infrastructure priority.
That third piece, the community participatory approach, can be very challenging. I wonder if you could share with our audience what you've seen around the country in terms of best practices of how people are bringing communities of patients together. What are people using as strategies to get at that patient stakeholder involvement that you've seen as being successful?
Well, first let me say, Margaret, that I completely agree with you. I like to say sometimes that what we do here at PCORI is community-based participatory research applied to clinical questions. We are not, by and large, studying issues in the community as much as issues in clinical decision-making, but we use all the principles that led to the development of this community-based participatory research movement. So, we have a very active website with lots of ways for patients to get engaged with us. We talk about building a patient and patient advocacy community across the country, and that's growing rapidly. We have online ways for patients to submit questions that we then process and put into the prioritization scheme. We just held a weekend event here in D.C., approximately 170 attendees, about 130 of them patient representatives from across the country. We had examples of amazing community-based research efforts partnered with clinicians and researchers. I'm thinking of one that's in Colorado called the High Plains Research Network. Okay. Just a remarkable partnership of clinicians who are in a practice-based network linked with researchers at the University of Colorado and with patients throughout Colorado and the surrounding states. So just very exciting. Patients have a hand in formulating the questions and in collecting and looking at the data. And that's just one of many, many examples. There are many online communities already formed, often organized around a particular disease, often around rare diseases. Mm-hmm. And those patients have come together in substantial part because they want to contribute to research. So we're looking for ways to partner with them. We're looking for ways to link these kinds of online communities with the clinical data that exist for them in electronic health records. Mm-hmm. So we think that's a part of the solution. We think that surveys and particularly social media type of surveys are a good way to keep our finger on the pulse. You know, we look for a lively, vibrant, two-way program of communication. We also are forming advisory panels. So these will be smaller numbers of people, but selected from large pools of applicants to be representative to help guide PCORI and advise PCORI. So they'll watch with us over time and keep us hopefully on the cutting edge of patient engagement. There's a lot to be learned just about how to do it right.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, Executive Director of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, known as PCORI, an independent nonprofit health research organization authorized by the Affordable Care Act. PCORI was created to provide patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. You know, I want to sort of pull the thread a little on one of the five priorities that you talked about before, and that was really on communication and dissemination. But I know we're engaged with the Dartmouth Institute on the clinical microsystems change process. And I know one of the biggest problems and challenges that we have, there are a lot of good practices and important things for people to do, but that the change process is very difficult out in the clinical setting. So past sharing the information, what other tools in the tool belt are you giving practices to help them with this transformation that they're all going to need to go through over the next many years?
Well, it's a very good question, Mark, and you are right that systems and the clinicians that work in them don't feel like they have a lot of time on their hands to sit around and discuss change. This is happening on the fly as they're very busy seeing patients and trying to make decisions. I think one principle that we're pretty convinced is important is that there has to be something in this for everybody. So clinicians and patients have to feel like they're getting something out of this process of change. It can't in any way be a top-down approach. So, you know, that takes us back to our principle of involving these key players from the beginning. Often these ideas are not one-size-fits-all ideas. So the same intervention doesn't necessarily work for 100% of patients. And if you're not careful, your interventions will improve care for some patients, but they could actually worsen disparities or differences between patients. So we think that is done better with patients at the table. And, you know, the third thing to say is that we will be funding implementation research. So we're very interested in how you take evidence and put it into practice. Mm-hmm. But a lot to be learned, as you suggest.
Well, Dr. Selby, one of the, I think the dichotomies certainly that we've seen historically is that the research lives within academia, the practice lives within the community, and the gap and the chasm between the two can be very broad because it takes, of course, skill and resources and training to do the research. Maybe you could speak to us a little bit about how are you seeing people bridge that gap? How are the universities and the traditional centers of research connecting with the community-based partners to do this critical work of designing the research studies that address the five key areas that PCORI is focusing on?
Well, you know, I think it is going to be a change. Having been one of those researchers, I think it does represent a change. In our very first announcements issued last May, we laid out these instructions that you must have relevant patients and other stakeholders involved in the team. And we got on the order of 1,300 letters of intent, people saying they were submitting applications. But when the application deadline came, we had just 488, and that's a remarkable fall off. Right. And when we polled people, the applicants who had said they were going to send us proposals, they told us that the main reason they didn't was because it was taking more time than they thought to establish these connections. Mm-hmm. So that's a signal to us that you're right, it's difficult, but on the other hand, the availability of research funding and the requirements we put in are having an effect. And over time, we're going to waste a tremendous opportunity if we don't study these interactions and learn from them what works the best. But we are very clearly seeing these partnerships. I mean, they were there before we came on the scene, and our funding is strengthening those partnerships. We really hope also that we see some new players at the table in terms of who's leading these. So we'll be delighted to see applications come in from community clinics, neighborhood health centers, patient organizations. We'll be delighted to see them in the lead of these applications and bringing researchers along to make sure we get the methods right.
Dr. Selby, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation in healthcare that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I think this appreciation, as we've been talking about already, of the critical care of systems and the potential for systems. Most people still get their care in settings that really, you'd have to admit, are not part of organized systems. So there's just a huge potential for organizing care more thoughtfully, for aligning the incentives of the various players so that people are talking to each other and they're on the same page. They're trying to accomplish the same thing, which is improved outcomes. And so I think systems have just an amazing amount going for them, and I think, you know, the Affordable Care Act recognizes that in many, many ways. And the second is this relatively new idea that whether we're talking about pills or surgeries or systematic approaches to care or health education, they're not going to work the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we have to pay a lot more attention than we have to the fact that patients are different. Patients differ in many ways, biologically and socially, and in their amount of social support, in their preferences. So whether we're talking, again, about medication, surgeries, or system interventions, more attention to who the patients are and tailoring those interventions, I think, is going to lead to what some call personalized medicine, but it's also going to just lead to smarter medicine and more efficient medicine. And goodness knows we need more efficient medicine.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, Executive Director of PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which is an independent, nonprofit health research organization committed to providing patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. You can find out more about his work by visiting www.pcori.org. Dr. Selby, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret.
I'm Arianna O'Hare with this tech report. Could our doppelganger be our best friend when it comes to weight loss? A University of Missouri researcher thinks so. Dr. Elizabeth Beam Morowitz is an assistant professor of communications at MU and wondered if a person's online avatar, that's their virtual representation of themselves in the virtual online social gaming world, could be used to influence their physical reality by altering their avatar to reflect a more idealized self. She decided to test her theory among practitioners in the online world Second Life, a virtual reality social networking site where people create an online avatar and interact with others.
So I was particularly interested in, I'm passionate about understanding how the virtual converges with our offline lives in ways that might be impactful on our cognitions and behavior. So how do the ways that we represent ourselves online and the ways that we interact online actually have a real impact on who we are offline?
What she found was when participants chose to create a more idealized self as an avatar and saw that thinner, fitter self interacting with others, that feeling translated back into their real lives.
Users felt more positively about themselves, so their self-worth was greater directly in relation to their interactions with their avatar. So they were able to consciously reflect on this and reflect on the experience in Second Life and state that this actually made them feel better about themselves offline.
Dr. B. Morowitz tested the body mass indexes of the participants before and after this study and found that while there wasn't a noticeable difference in size, there was a notable difference in the self-esteem levels and commitment to behaviors that will lead to weight loss. While she plans to conduct longer-term studies to measure the health impacts, her next test area will be in diversity, allowing people to try on different races, even genders, for more diversity understanding.
And so the idea of harnessing virtual worlds or virtual reality like Second Life for diversity training purposes is that it allows someone to step into someone else's shoes. So to take on the identity of someone that is different from the self, so maybe a different gender, different race or ethnicity.
Her work is in this month's edition of Computers and Human Behavior. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.